Hello, this is Evan Ratliff, Editor-in-Chief of the Atavist Magazine. You're listening to Episode 2 of The Ghosts of Pickering Trail, the latest installment of the Atavist Magazine podcast. If you haven't listened to Episode 1, we recommend that you start there. In the first episode, we met Janet Milliken, who moved her two children from California to Pennsylvania to start over after the death of their father. The house seemed idyllic, and then they began to experience strange, unsettling events. A neighbor informed them that the previous occupants of their home had died in a murder-suicide less than a year before they moved in. They sued to try to get the house sale rescinded, and as part of that lawsuit, they retained a man named Randall Bell, who is an expert in stigmatized properties. Here's Will Hunt and Matt Wolf with the second episode of The Ghosts of Pickering Trail.
After moving in, Janet Milliken began having a recurring dream. She was at the family's old vacation home on the shore of a lake near Yosemite National Park. Her husband was there too. He'd look at her and say, "Where have you been? I've been looking for you." And she'd say, "I didn't know you'd be coming back. I never would have moved if I knew you were coming back." Then she'd wake up. On a brisk morning in the spring of 2010, Milliken sat across from Randall Bell at her kitchen table. Milliken didn't know what to make of him. For a world-famous expert, he seemed very casual. He'd just flown in from California and wore a button-down shirt, khakis, and a pair of Ray-Bans hanging from croquis. But he exuded an optimism that she found reassuring. If she had any chance of winning the case, Bell would need to prove definitively that the murder had created a material defect, a condition that negatively affected her house just as surely as any physical damage. "Janet," Bell said gently, "why don't you tell me about your house?" Milliken spoke slowly in measured sentences. At times, her voice cracked with emotion. Her first impulse upon discovering the house's history, Milliken said, had been to hide it from her kids. As long as Ryan and Kendra didn't know about the deaths, she figured she could probably live with it. She wanted to make their transition into a new neighborhood and a new school as easy as possible. But a girl in Kendra's eighth-grade homeroom who also lived in the subdivision asked her about it. "How could you live there?" the girl asked. Kendra asked what she meant. "There was," the girl said, "an incident." During the first weeks of school, Ryan, too, had been hearing whispers from classmates about a death in the house. Together, they confronted their mother. Wanting to protect them, Milliken initially denied knowing anything. When Ryan and Kendra persisted, she relented and told them the whole story. When she finished, the kids were seething. Ryan and Kendra had never wanted to move east. "We were so against it from day one," Kendra recalled later. "You could have given us candy and $100 and we still would have said, this place is awful." They resented their mother for taking them away from their friends. "How could you do this to us?" Ryan asked. Milliken had wanted to make the move perfect for her children. She'd read everything she could about the area, checked out the local school systems, even searched for sex offenders. And yet there was one thing she hadn't thought to check. She felt like she had failed them. Milliken had difficulty explaining to family and friends what it was like to live in a house that constantly reminded her of violent death. She found it more depressing than scary. The memories associated with the property seemed to exert a subtle, pernicious effect, like a low-pitched hum. More than anything, though, the house felt heavy, a burden she could not cast off. Occasionally, the stress of living there built up and registered itself in strange ways. One afternoon that fall, for example, Milliken and Kendra were upstairs when they heard Ryan shout. They ran downstairs to find him standing in the kitchen, pointing at a purple marker on the counter. The marker, he said, had rolled across the counter by itself, as though pushed by some invisible force. Not long after, Kendra stayed home sick one morning from school. She was soaking in a hot bath just as Milliken left to drive Ryan to school. She started feeling uncomfortable. "It felt like there was someone in the next room," she recalled. Suddenly, the door to the bathroom swung open. Kendra froze. Eventually, she got up the nerve to get out of the tub, wrap herself in a towel, and walk through the halls. There was no one in the house. "Mom," Kendra said when Milliken got home, "we have ghosts." Milliken tried to calm her children, but she, too, was beginning to have unusual experiences. One night she awoke from a deep sleep with the distinct sensation that someone was poking her in the back. She sat up in bed but found no one. On another night, she felt someone sit down beside her on the mattress. When she looked around, she was alone. This was not the first time Milliken had had experiences of this sort. After Milliken's mother died, she cut a lock of her hair as a keepsake. Several nights later, as she slept, she felt someone pulling her own hair in the exact same place. And back in California, after Frank's death, she would wake up in the middle of the night to the sound of a printer printing in Frank's home office. When she walked down the hall, the sound would stop, and the office would be empty. Hardly a week passed at 12 Pickering Trail without an unsettling encounter of one kind or another. As Kendra described it, there was often a sense of walking into a room and feeling as though someone had just walked out. On some nights, Milliken would wake up and hear a child's voice calling out. She'd go out in the hall and find the house quiet. Or late at night, Kendra would hear footsteps on the stairs. She'd open her bedroom door to see that everyone was asleep. Once, Ryan burst into Milliken's room in a panic, saying he'd heard a gun being cocked. Another time, it was a shadow passing through his room. Milliken once heard loud, insistent knocking on the front door. When she rushed downstairs, the stoop was empty. Even their dog seemed to react badly. Their black lab, Onyx, who'd been well-behaved in California, began flying into barking fits. Milliken didn't believe that vengeful spirits dwelled in her home, but the house felt haunted. When she walked into her bedroom, she still involuntarily imagined the Kumbulises. Even if it was all in her head, these were not ghosts that could be ignored. Her family's reaction to the house seemed to feed on itself. It became hard not to see a supernatural motive behind every negative event. One morning, not long after she learned of the Kumbulis tragedy, Milliken returned home to find firefighters at her house and the ground floor full of smoke. The blaze was put out before it caused significant damage. It had started, the firefighter said, when a pan of brownies on the stovetop had caught fire. Milliken explained that she had left the brownies to cool overnight, but that no one had touched the stove that morning. "Mom," Ryan and Kendra shrieked, "it's them. They're telling us to get out. They don't want us here." Milliken tried to reassure them. Onyx had probably tried to jump up for the brownies and accidentally turned on the stove with his paw. And yet the house seemed cursed. On one evening, not long after, the family went out to a restaurant to celebrate Kendra's birthday. When they came home, they found Onyx in the living room, dead. Somehow he'd gotten stuck in a bag of dog food and suffocated. Milliken saw her children struggling. On afternoons when Milliken couldn't pick up Ryan and Kendra from school, they'd stay late to avoid being in the house alone. She found herself making frequent trips to the principal's office to talk about Ryan's behavior. A counselor diagnosed him with arrested bereavement. Kendra, meanwhile, found it hard to make friends because she was ashamed to invite them over to her house. "My grades, family, and sanity are falling apart, as is my life," Kendra wrote in her diary around that time. Milliken worried constantly, while lack of sleep left her feeling exhausted. The final straw came on the night of February 11th, 2008, the two-year anniversary of the murder-suicide. Shortly before midnight, Milliken woke up to Ryan screaming. He had been sleeping on the floor of his bedroom. He preferred not to sleep in the bed, when he saw a dark shadow in the corner of the room. Then he saw a menacing figure with flashing green eyes. When he rolled on his back, he looked up at the digital display on his clock radio, which read 11:34. But upside down, as Ryan saw them, the digits read H-E-L-L. He woke his sister and rushed into Milliken's bedroom. "We have to get out of this house now," said Ryan. They all put on coats over their pajamas and piled into the minivan. Milliken drove through the quiet streets, hoping the kids would calm down. After an hour, she pulled into an empty parking lot. Ryan and Kendra begged her to check them into a hotel. Milliken tightened her grip on the steering wheel and shook her head no. They were just letting their fear take over, she told them. They were going to go back. It was around then, Milliken told Bell, that she decided to fight the Jaconos in court. Whatever the time and expense, her family needed to get out of that house. Bell nodded. He knew from other clients about the stresses of living in a stigmatized property. It was common, he said, to feel vulnerable. After she finished, Milliken felt a sense of relief. She'd avoided talking about her experiences with Ryan and Kendra for fear of deepening their anxiety. When she brought up the incidents on the phone with her sisters, they would gently change the subject.
Bell, a practicing Mormon, does not believe in ghosts, or rather, he has never seen one. He does, however, believe in the caprices of human perception and the power of illusion. He holds one of the world's largest collections of Houdini memorabilia, second only to the magician David Copperfield. A haunted house is a perception, Bell once explained. If a property is perceived as haunted, it's haunted. If you don't think it's haunted, it isn't. Traces of violent death, Bell knew, frequently linger long after the blood is scrubbed away. Some people, Bell has found, were more susceptible to feeling this than others. Over the years, he had come to see the sensitivity not as an irrational delusion, but as a kind of empathy, a deeply felt connection to the dead. Bell began at the Millikens, as he did all his appraisals, by inspecting the house and taking notes and photographs as he went. He made his way through each room, pausing in the master bedroom. No evidence of the crime remained, but he couldn't help picturing Georgia Kambulis bleeding on the floor, inches from where Milliken's bed now stood. He saw that after several years of occupancy, the space didn't seem lived in. The walls were bare of decoration or family photographs. It was clear that Milliken refused to accept this house as a home. Stigma, like most psychological phenomena, does not lend itself to precise measurement. Yet Bell had found that it reliably expresses itself economically. To determine an event's effect on property value, Bell takes the price of a comparable, unstigmatized property and, using case studies drawn from his own research, calculates a percentage of depreciation. The exact percentage depends on the severity of the stigma, the elasticity of the local real estate market, and a host of other factors that can intensify or diminish the impact. Suicides, according to Bell, create less stigma than murders, but both create more than sexual assaults. Unsolved crimes create more stigma than those for which a suspect is apprehended. A murder that happens indoors creates more stigma than a murder that occurs outdoors. A murder involving a child is especially bad. Widely reported crimes create dramatically more stigma than those that are ignored. Peaceful deaths and nonviolent crimes carry little to no stigma. Murders in low-crime neighborhoods tend to attract more stigma than murders in high-crime neighborhoods. On average, most stigmatized properties, Bell estimates, sell at a discount of between 15% and 25%, and take significantly longer to find a buyer. Some houses can be effectively destroyed by stigma. Such incurable properties, class 10 on the Bell chart, are almost invariably demolished. The most stigmatized residence Bell has studied was Jeffrey Dahmer's Milwaukee apartment. Dahmer, who murdered and defiled 17 men and boys, didn't just pull down the value of his apartment or his apartment building, but that of the entire neighborhood. After he was apprehended, occupancy rates in adjoining buildings plummeted. Residents of the neighborhood finally pooled their money, bought the building, and tore it down. In 1997, Bell consulted the owner of the San Diego mansion that was the site of the Heaven's Gate suicides. For a time, it was impossible to open a magazine without seeing images of the bodies draped in purple cloaks and wearing matching black Nikes. When the property was finally sold after sitting on the market for 2 years, the new owner chose to raze everything within its borders. Mansion, trees, lawn, gardens, tennis court, and driveways, reducing the site to a dusty patch of earth. Bell says, though, that even the worst stigma eventually fades. The house is usually unsellable immediately after a crime. But within 3 to 7 years, most properties recover nearly all their value. Forgotten violence loses its power to haunt. Were this not the case, of course, many more properties would be stigmatized. In the 1800s, it was common for people to die in their own homes and even have funerals there. The architectural term coffin corner, denoting a niche in a steep staircase, refers to the idea that the stairs would one day be used to transport a casket. Many homes built before 1900 have, at one point or another, contained a corpse. As Bell walked through Janet Milliken's house, he noted that the Jaconos had followed much of the advice he usually gives clients trying to sell a stigmatized property. Joseph Jacona had renovated large portions of the interior and caught up on years of deferred maintenance. The only advice he did not follow was to be transparent about the house's history. Bell always advises clients to make a full disclosure. At the end of the day, he flew back to California. In his office, he spread out the notes and photographs from his visit and set to work assembling the report that, he hoped, would help rescue the Millikens from their home.
Every culture has its own rituals for cleansing a place of bad energy. The Cherokee burn sage, filling the afflicted space with fragrant smoke. Taoist priests perform a ritual in which they drop rice liquor into a wok of boiling oil, creating a great flame that expels unwanted ghosts. Japanese Buddhist shamans shake a shakujo, a stick threaded with metal rings, producing a loud rattling sound intended to frighten away bad spirits. While she was stuck living in the house, waiting for the lawsuit to run its course, Milliken, who is Catholic, called nearby St. Maximilian Kolbe Church and asked for a priest to perform a blessing in her home. The church sent Monsignor Carroll, who read a prayer from the Book of Blessings and sprinkled holy water around the living room. Milliken had felt hopeful as he spoke, but when she walked the priest to his car, she began to cry. Milliken knew that she couldn't cleanse the house of its old memories, but maybe she could fill it with new ones. For Thanksgiving, she invited two of her sisters, her brother-in-law, and her nieces and nephews over for dinner. She worked in the kitchen for hours, but as soon as the kids broke off from the adults, Kendra and Ryan's cousins started playing a game where they'd creep up the stairs of the master bedroom, peek in, and run down the stairs screaming and giggling. At the dinner table, the conversation turned to the murder-suicide and the strange experiences her family had been having in the home. Milliken worried that the memories of the house would never fade. One morning, while Ryan and Kendra were at school, Milliken went into her bedroom and closed the door. She kneeled on the floor at the foot of her bed with a rosary in her hands. "Whoever you are, this is not your home," she said, timid at first, then raising her voice. "This is my house. These are my children. You're scaring me. You're frightening my children." Her voice echoed in the sparsely furnished room. "Get out now." She opened her eyes, found herself in her empty bedroom, and felt faintly embarrassed. A few weeks after his visit, Bell sent Milliken a copy of his report on her house. When Milliken saw the numbers from Bell's appraisal, she realized that the house wasn't just a psychological burden, but a financial one. After comparing it to other houses in the neighborhood and other stigmatized properties, Bell determined that due to the lingering stigma of the Kambua's tragedy, Milliken's house had depreciated 10-15% from its value when she purchased it. Were she to sell the house, she would likely have to accept offers between $61,000 and $91,500 beneath what she paid for it in 2007. Of course, she noted ruefully, that was only if she disclosed the murder. Its value, in fact, was even lower, as the housing market was still depressed from the recent crash. The only way she would be able to leave the house without losing much of her investment would be to have the sale rescinded.
This has been episode 2 of 3 of The Ghosts of Pickering Trail on the Atavis Magazine podcast. The story is by Will Hunt and Matt Wolf. It was written for the Atavis Magazine. Check back this week for the final installment or subscribe. This podcast was edited by Megan Dietry. The story was edited by Katya Bachko and fact-checked by Aviva Stahl. I'm Evan Ratliff, the editor-in-chief of the Atavis Magazine, and you'll find us online at magazine.atavis.com.